one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So, you've done your roll call as needed.
Yes, I know who's here and who's not.
Yeah, okay.
Before we go any further, I just want to introduce y'all to Electra. This is our new secretary. She is my secretary in Sandy Valley also and lives in Sandy Valley. Oh. And so I'm very thankful that she's agreeing to be our secretary here. So,
thank you.
Please be nice to her.
So we have a public comment period now, and we're devoted to comments by the general public about items on this agenda. No discussion, action, or vote may be taken on this agenda item at this time, and you can speak on individual public hearing items at the time they are presented as well. If you wish to speak to the council about items within its jurisdiction but not appearing on this agenda, you must wait until the comments by the general public period listed at the end of this agenda. Comments are limited to 3 minutes. Please step up to the non-existent speaker's podium, if applicable. Clearly state your name and address, and please spell your last name for the record if any of the members of the council wishes to extend the length of a presentation. This will be done by me, the chairperson, or the council by majority vote. So anybody have a public comment applicable to this period? Okay.
Chichi Bengochea, Bengochea. About a year ago, I brought up an item for consideration or submitted for consideration expanding the playground on the park, and I never heard back, and it's been brought up a few times, and I was just wondering how we can get that item to the table somehow.
No. We need to just have the meeting with the commissioner, so we just need to coordinate with the commissioner to come out and so you can talk to him and everything about it. So it's a coordination issue. It's a coordination issue.
It's a coordination issue?
Yeah, so I'll give you his executive assistant's number, and he doesn't schedule.
To Justin Jones' office?
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay to schedule an appointment?
Because
we tried before, but it wasn't a good time last
time. Well.
Understood. Okay, I'll do that.
Thank you, PG.
Also,
for anyone else who might want to make a comment, I'll point out, though, that this is actually the period for comments about items on this agenda. Specifically right now. Anybody have any of those? No, and there'll be more opportunities to comment when the agenda items come up. Are you recording, by the way?
I am. Perfect.
Oh, it must be hidden behind. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
We had a problem, but I didn't record them anymore.
Okay, approval of minutes for February 1st for possible action. I see other than Dallas, is Dennis your real name or something?
Oh, I'll fix that. I don't know where that came from.
Hmm.
Other than that, I
didn't see anything that odd through the evil eye.
No, I'm fine with it.
Everybody's okay with it?
Fine with it.
So on the minutes, it's just that I had Dallas as name as Dennis for whatever reason.
So, anybody want to move to approve February 1st meeting?
I move to approve the meeting minutes for February 1st, 2023.
Thank you, Stephanie, and approve, and I'll approve it as well. So, Dallas, are you moving to approve, or?
I move to approve.
Approve, so, unanimous. All right. Approval of tonight's agenda, and we want to hold, combine, or delete any actions.
Looks good to me.
Okay, so you're moving to approve.
I move to approve tonight's agenda.
And we'll second that. And we're unanimous in approval of tonight's agenda. Moving right along. So informational items, we received a report from the Las Vegas Valley Water District regarding current well levels, status of the Blue Diamond water system, and other related concerns. Jordan, oh, there you are, Jordan. I didn't see where you sit. Okay.
Jordan Bunker, Las Vegas Valley Water District. Just a quick update on the wells, and then we'll geek out a little bit more here in a few minutes about the hydrology. The monthly reading for the James Hardy North and South wells was completed last week, March 22nd. The North well has a static water level of 21.84 feet below land surface. The South well static water level is 21.62 feet below land surface. So that's still about a foot and a half lower than where we were in March of last year, but it's about a foot higher than where we were in last month. So fantastic news, and obviously with all the precipitation we've been getting, that's the reason. And we'll be looking to hopefully see some more recharge here in the next couple of months. So other than that, the water system is currently in stable operating condition. The contractor is beginning to wrap up the water line replacements. I believe I was on a construction meeting today, and I think he said that they're going to pave Allegro and Cerrito tomorrow, and that the work on Cottonwood is about 70% done. So they're looking to have that job wrapped up here within the next month, which is also great news.
Jordan, they've been doing a great job. Please thank them.
Awesome. They will love to hear that. Thank
they
you.
They really have, and they're so accommodating. It's like they have just been, I mean, they've brought in like steel plates, they'll get us out of driveways. They've been really accommodating because they know they're all in the way.
That is fantastic yeah. to hear, and we appreciate that.
We've gotten to know them well.
Awesome. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions?
Jordan, did they put those little sensors on the line like they had on the old one to detect where there might be a leak?
I haven't heard specifically that they did that. It was, I believe, pretty much all of the pipelines that we're installing these days includes leak detection. Is that your understanding?
We come out and we'll do leak detection, but as far as I know, our asset management group is not like putting stuff that's going to be doing constant sensing for leaks right now. But we'll go out and listen to services and things like that.
Good to know.
Okay. Any other comments, questions for Jordan? Okay. And then I assume we have a deeper hydrology report this evening?
Or that's under general business. Yeah, general business.
Oh, that's under general business. I see. Thank you. Okay. So thank you, Jordan. And now we receive a report from Metro regarding activity and statistics for the past month and other area policing concerns. Do we have somebody here from Metro?
They're not here. No, they were on a kind of a high-speed chase, I think. Something.
No, that's BLM. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll have to...
But BLM lost one.
Yeah, so now it's receive a report from BLM regarding current upcoming projects, updates on the Legacy Bike Trail, information on the Red Rock National Conservation Area, and other updates about public lands in this area. I guess
do you want
that,
the law enforcement BLM or mine first?
Well, you guys could fight it out, and whichever one wants to go first. You know?
So the big thing on the Legacy Trail is the Southern Nevada Public Land Management Act Round 19 proposals was officially signed, and that is for the construction of Phase 3 and 4. So just to give a really quick overview on the Legacy Trail, it's a five-phase project starting essentially at Sky Vista, or the very end of Summerlin. And then phase one runs along the north side of the 159, all the way to the Red Rock Fee Station. And then there's two parts of phase two, but the one part goes from the fee station all the way to the exit. Then the other part of phase two goes essentially from where the Red Rock sign is, on the other side, so not the one closer to this community. From there all the way to Moencopie Road or the campground road into the campground and just under the 159 back on phase one. And then phase three is going to run from that feed booth, or no, the scenic loop exit to Bonnie Spring, and then phase four is Bonnie Spring, roughly just past this community here in Blue Diamond. So with SNPLMA being signed, it kind of begins a process of kind of the bureaucracy of putting in to the funding, getting the funding request, putting in a work plan proposal. So that's where we're at now with the Legacy Trail.
I thought the trail was funded. I'm wrong about that?
Certain segments are funded, and then certain components. The design was fully funded, and that's been fully funded for a while.
I see.
So now we're moving into more construction and finishing out some of the other components.
Thank you.
Funded there. Busy season at Red Rock. We're kind of in that spring break rush, but we've also gotten a lot of welcome moisture, which has been really convenient, but we've seen a lot of the recreation for other activities spread to other parts of the National Conservation Area, so we're seeing a lot of our, especially our limestone is getting more use with the climbing community now that there's all the rain. So that's kind of our big updates on those projects. I think last time we spoke, we mentioned the Cottonwood, which is kind of this general area, that recreation area management plan was awaiting cultural survey. So those are in. So our project manager and our cultural specialist are looking at that to create a final proposal that protects the natural and cultural resources as well as provides a nice designated trail system to ultimately provide recreation for present and future generations in a sustainable way. And those are the big updates for Red Rock at this time. Any
Thank
questions?
You.
When are you going to start building it?
That is probably early 2025, maybe late 2024 for phase one. So there's the planning process, the engineering, then there's the environmental analysis component, as well as just actually arranging all of the funding, getting the construction contracts in place.
And it may not seem like it, but this project, as far as federal, is moving super fast. I mean, I know it doesn't seem like it, but it's amazingly fast that we've gotten this far and gotten all this funding. It's what, $96 million now?
Yeah, it'll probably end up being over 100.
So yeah, it I know it seems slow, but it's progressing all the time, and it's huge too. It's a huge project, so be patient. It's gonna be awesome.
Yeah, and from my understanding, it's also been an idea that's been in the docket for a while, for some time, but officially starting the project. It officially began for, I think, 2019.
Okay.
Well, yeah, thank you, everyone. I need to run. I had an early morning, but if you have any questions or want to contact me, feel free to get my information from Megan. Email's probably the easiest way, if you don't mind. So, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So
from our end on the law enforcement side, just want to give you guys a reminder about vehicle break-ins and vehicle burglaries that are happening. We're upwards of 30 just for this year. So we're getting hit a lot. So just be very conscious when you're parking your car, lock your car, take all your valuables, don't bring them with you. If you're going to go hiking, take it with you when you're out on the trails. But today we were hit twice. Mm-hmm. So it's happening pretty frequently. I mean, staying pretty much out of the Blue Diamond area, but these groups that are coming through are just looking for easy targets, and that's pretty easy when you got our two that we've got going. So be diligent when you're out there. We're doing our best. We've had three arrests so far, so we're trying to get prosecution through the AUSAs that we're working with, but it's an ongoing effort. Speed for all of our visitors on 159, as you know, 50 miles an hour, and our speeders are just increasing exponentially. I know you all know about all the motorcycles that come through. Just be very diligent when you're driving on the roads, because they are 100 plus of all the motorcycles that we're trying to stop they're not stopping for us, so we're not chasing them. It's caused any other issues. Our search and rescue is on an uptick with our spring break, so we're busy with that too. And just so you know, we work with the Metro resident officers all the time, so if you have any other comments or concerns, please let us know. I can get that back to Metro. And the desert sportsman, the Skid Row area. Did you end up?
I have a report on that.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
it's going to be no longer pretty soon.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah. If you guys have any other questions, let me know. I'll be around.
So what's the majority of what's happening?
It's pretty consistent around the scenic loop and on 159 at all of our trips, but we're having every one hit. I don't really take care of Blue Diamond. I will come if Metro requests us and I'll help, but we haven't, not that I know of, had any in Blue Diamond at this point.
And what is your name, by the way?
Ranger Styler. I'm the lieutenant out here for Red Rock.
Ray Styler?
No, Mike Styler.
Mike Styler. Oh, thank you.
Question about people camping alongside the road, the road at night. There's lots of car parks all along.
Yeah, it's not legal to camp. Well, it's legal to be out on the trails.
No, people are sleeping on the in the vehicles.
Yeah, it's not legal.
Can you all speak up so that and
I'm never
talking
on that.
Talking about camping and all the cars that are parked on the 159.
Yeah.
The one that she's going to bring up about the desert sportsman is different. I mean, that's a different area, but yes, we try to.
Get working. If it's other places, I'm not talking about that one, but the big one.
You're talking about all.
Is that the one in front of the detention base?
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to report on that.
Cool.
I honk every time I drive by. Yeah, yeah. 10 o'clock at night.
I want to, but I feel like it feels like they're sort of down on their luck over there, and you don't really want to, you know.
I don't think that's
no, they're not.
Yeah, I think you've got a combination of much. They're enjoying it over there, and you've got some that are living in vehicles, and some that are just traveling and hiking and climbing too.
Yeah.
It's a lifestyle.
So have there been any Calico Basin break-ins? In these?
Craft Mountain and, yeah.
Yeah.
We've had break-ins in Calico.
Craft Mountain, but not the paved parking
lot.
Not the Red Springs lot also? Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Ranger Styler.
You're welcome.
And did we get your name?
Brayden Guard. And I'm I can introduce myself if you don't know. I'm the assistant field manager for the Red Rock Swamp Field Office.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any more questions for BLM at this point? Thank you all. Thank you very much.
Before you go on, can we just revisit the minutes? One second. One
quick
change.
Your chance is done.
We already voted to approve, man.
Yes, what?
Oh, it's unless you change your name, it
no,
says
she knows.
Oh,
yeah. She already mentioned that.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
She got it.
Why don't you rub salt in that one?
I emailed you on it, but you know.
Yeah, I did.
Dennis.
Oh, okay. I thought it would avoid a public
incident.
A lot of stuff happening right now.
All right, so it's me. So, and of course, Greg isn't here, the one who had asked about it, but Greg had asked for statistics about the safety of 159. And so I was working with NDOT to pull the statistics, and I was going to do all this crunching of numbers and everything. You guys know I'm nerdy like that, and I love to do that. But they have it all done already. So there's a whole report here, and I will leave a copy here. I'm pretty sure it's available on their website. They emailed it to me. It's 42 pages. It's super in-depth. But I pulled out the excerpts that are about 159. So I just have two extra copies. You guys can pass those around if you want to look. There's a lot to digest there, so you'll probably want to look at it. When you have a chance, but it lists all the stuff I would have pulled out. How many crashes there were.
What is the period for this table? It doesn't say.
In the whole report, I think it does.
I know.
To 2019.
Okay.
And on their website, It's really cool. Again, if you're nerdy like me, it's really cool. You can go and they have maps like this. And you can zoom in and click on individual spots and it'll tell you all the statistics for that accident. When it happened, what was involved, what the weather was like, time of day, everything. So these only go through 2019 because their stats are usually behind. But if you want more up-to-date stuff, you can pull it on there. And you can like go on and circle an area on the website, and it'll give you the list of all the accidents that were in that little area. So it's very interesting. But so I'll leave this with the library. I think it's probably available on their website. And I know there's more questions about like the traffic circles and stuff, so I'm going to ask NDOT if they can come to the meeting next month to give some more information. So that's that. I didn't check them, but I was told, and of course Barbara is not here for this announcement. If you guys have attended the meeting in the past few years, you know Barbara hates the dogs in the rodeo. I got Public Works to agree to remove them. So I don't know if they've been removed yet, but they are going to be gone. So
what
very doing? Anticlimactic because she's not here. The they're not called dots. They're called like RPGs or something.
Yeah, the center line.
Yeah, those little dots in the middle of the road.
Down the arroyo. Are they going to just single line, do two single lines?
I don't know what they're going to do. But they're removing the dots. That's all I know. That was what I wanted.
Yeah.
Transform Clark County, the comment period for the first consolidated draft was up last week. They've been, planning has been going around to all the commissioners meeting, going over some of the changes and the comments that have come in. I put in a whole bunch of comments about rural stuff. Some were changed, some weren't. Some of the things that I felt strongly about that weren't changed, I found out why. Our code, Title 30, does not handle animal stuff very well, livestock stuff. And they didn't change any of it. And I was like, what the heck? You know, well, because it's such a big document and the livestock is so, it really needs to be studied on its own, not as a part of the bigger, we're going to leave it as it is for right now and then do a study on it. Same with lighting. And I just found that out today and I'm actually really glad. Because they're recognizing that we can have different standards for rural areas. And if somebody wants to get, I've done a little bit of research into becoming a dark skies community, which is bizarre. If you can't sleep, try looking at how to be a dark skies community. But one of the things that they, I always thought to be a dark skies community, you would get that designation and then rules would go along with that designation. It's exactly the opposite. You have to have the rules in place and then they'll certify you. Mm-hmm. It's weird. But by doing this, I think we would be able to have the rules in place to do that. So I think this is a good thing. So those two things that we're going to study a little bit later, and I think there's one more, but it was something commercial. It didn't have anything to do with us. So of course, they didn't make all the changes we wanted, but we're working on it. So they'll be bringing another final draft back. They're hoping in the beginning of June. So I'll let you all know the next.
Megan, I have a question about that. Water. So it read a little. So some of the water restrictions that are in place for the rest of Clark County, are they assumed to be in place here even though we're on a different water source?
It is irrelevant what the water source is because...
Okay, because it read specifically that in the other code that it does name the source. It does say from Lake Mead, so I just wanted to make sure.
Okay, well then you know what, I better check.
Yeah, can you check on it? Because I thought the same thing, like, well, if this, you know, if there's a pool with size restriction there, then we get the same pool with size restriction.
Well, the pool size restriction for sure is everywhere.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I had this argument with the developer.
But do you remember exactly where that clause was? Because we saw in the clause, I'll find it and email it to you, Megan, but okay. There was a specific thing that specifically named Lake Mead Water. So we put comments into the Red Rock overlay where we wanted to make sure that distinction was also covered for this water source.
Right. Everything else in Title 30 applies everywhere.
Right.
So I would think it would, but that's a really good point. So yes, you please email me, and we'll follow up with that.
We talked about not having grass in cemeteries, and not having grass in common areas of subdivisions, and we talked about not having water features.
I know, and a lot of the work that we did to try to change the overlay, we are not able to do right now because of the ongoing lawsuit. So that's about all I can say about it. It's, believe me, I spent hours. You know how much time I spent on it, hours and hours. And it's very frustrating to you too, so that's where we are. It's not dead, it's just for right now. The LETAP, L-E-T-A-P-E, I don't speak French, so I don't know if that's correct. It's the Grand Prix, it's not the Grand Prix, it's the Tour de France. The Tour de France is coming here. And it's gonna come through here. I will have a presentation for you next month. I think someone from the top is going to be here, but it's going to come through Red Rock and through here, and it's very exciting. Apparently, this is a big deal. They do them all over the world, so this is going to be our first one here. It's the first weekend of May, so I'll have more details on that next month. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's going to be May of this year?
Yeah, May 6th and 7th, I think.
Wow.
And...
May 6th and 7th of this year.
This year, yeah. That's crazy that we're only hearing that.
Yeah, we don't know. Oh, it was in the RJ. There was an announcement. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's been all over, but it's just, they're just gearing up, like, now, because they do them all over the world, so they're gearing up for this one starting now. So, so it's going to be cool. It'll be frustrating, you know, traffic, stuff coming through, but I think probably the excitement will be kind of worth it to see something really cool. So, and Skid Row. I didn't know they called it Skid Row until last year. So Skid Row has been a problem for a long time, and it's kind of one of those problems that nobody knows what to do with it. It's NDOT right-of-way, but they're there because they're going to BLM land to climb, and it's unclear if it should be Metro's jurisdiction or BLM law enforcement or NHP. And I'll admit, we've been kind of kicking it down the road. And I know it sucks, but we didn't even know what to do with it. So push came to shove last week, and I committed to doing something about it, just because I'm a glutton for punishment. So I decided that I would take that on. And I am working with NDOT. We are going to close off that whole area so that they can't even park there. I know that will probably push them to other areas. And one thing that I found out, I thought there was some reason they couldn't go to the campground, because the campground's like 2 miles from there. I mean, if they just went up and turned left, it's right there. And from what Brayden told me, they don't want to have to pay $8 a night. But they go up there and get water. So the whole thing is baloney.
So the campground's not full?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. From what I've been told.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they don't want to follow the rules in the campground, which I can't believe. Are there that many crazy rules that they can't follow?
They don't want to pay the money.
$8 a night. Because I asked him, because I've gone camping places that it's kind of expensive. $8. So I have zero sympathy anymore. So we're done. Mm-hmm. So
I have a question. Is BLM... do you guys have the ability to enforce getting them out of the other parking lots easier than that one? Because I know there was always...
So that parking lot is not ours.
Oh, that's kind of what I figured. Right. So yeah. if they start to shift to all the other trailheads, you guys have jurisdiction to actually have them removed or ticketed?
Yeah, that's why I haven't been complaining too much about Skid Row.
That one
is a weird...
That's what I thought.
It's interjurisdictional. Mm-hmm. It's everyone's and no one's. And so it has been... It's a hard one. So I got the commitment from NDOT today that I don't know what it's going to look like, but there's going to be no parking there anymore, and it's not going to happen next week, I promise. It's going to take a little bit to figure it all out, because we also have to make sure there's still access to the retention basin, to the gun club, all that stuff. So, but that's coming.
Okay.
So, there you go. So, any questions for me?
No, but good job on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I finally just had to suck it up and say, I think I did something about it. It's not even, and to tell you the truth, it has nothing to do with county. Well, it's not county in any way, but
start utilizing the campground.
Yeah. $8.
Right.
Okay. Park a car with a
sprinkler. Oh, look who's chosen to join us.
No, no worries.
I'm cleaning up Skid Row.
Oh, thank God. About time.
and excerpts from...
That's all you.
Thank you.
From okay.
Except my birthday.
All right. All right. Yeah, that's all you.
So is that it for you?
That's it for me.
Thank you, Megan. Does anyone have any questions for Megan on this stuff? No, we're good. Excellent. So we don't have any planning and zoning stuff. We have under general business, Jim Pryor going to give us a hydrology report. Are you doing it, Jordan?
Yeah, well, I'll just start off real quick. Jordan Bunker again with the Las Vegas Federal Water District. We appreciate the opportunity to be here to give this presentation, to share this information with you, the hydrology here in the region. We've been trying to do this for, gosh, the past 4 or 5 or 6 months. For whatever reason, it's kept getting pushed back. But that has actually ended up being a really good thing with all the precipitation that has fallen. We are now able to give you a much more complete picture than we otherwise would have been back in November or even January. So this is Jim Freer. He is a principal hydrologist with the Las Vegas Valley Water District, Southern Nevada Water Authority. And he will give the presentation.
Hey, thank you very much. It's nice to be here. Maybe I'll sort of come over here so you don't have to look over your shoulder if this works out. Yes. Does everybody have a handout?
Yes. Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you again. We know we've been working with Barbara trying to set this up. And this has actually worked out much better because we know now that we're about halfway through the water year and we know what the winter precipitation is. And luckily this year has been very good. It's been above normal. And what I wanted to do tonight is basically just spend a little time and talk about what our current conditions are. How does that compare to the historical record that we have over the last 30 years for precipitation in the region, in the area here? And then talk about how does that transfer into groundwater recharge and what are the factors associated with that? And how much of this would we expect to actually infiltrate into the ground and see in terms of what our groundwater levels might be later this year? And then also take a look at the long-term perspective of that. What has that fit into the period of record that we have for the last 20 to 30 years and see where that at. And then after we're done with that, we'll see how does that fit into where the wells are under construction of those wells. And then look at what we expect in the future outlook, in terms of if there's changes in warmer temperatures coming up over the next several decades, what are the implications of that in terms of groundwater recharge and the future concerns for the water resources in the area. And, Blue Diamond really isn't a unique aquifer system. My background is in hydrogeology my whole career. And one of the limits with Blue Diamond is that the aquifer system is very, very small laterally. It's not laterally extensive like in a lot of areas where you have a lot of storage. And it's also a very thin saturated thickness. And we'll get into that a little bit. Especially in this wash area, which is the most transmissive where the wells are completed. But let me just walk through this. If anybody has any questions, just let me know. We can kind of go through this. So first, the first page is just to give a kind of a regional picture of the watershed that affects Blue Diamond and the water supply. Basically, we outlined the Blue Diamond watershed. And this is an area about 25 square miles, about 16,500 acres. Where if you took a cup of water and poured it on the ground, what direction would it go to? And if it wasn't taken up by evaporation or tied up in the soil, it would eventually work its way down into the wash and then out of the area. But this just gives an idea of what the recharge area is for the town's water supply in terms of where it fits into the entire region. Now, if we look on the next page, what this figure shows is a kind of encapsulation of what the Red Rock area precipitation has been this year compared to the last 2 years, compared to the average since 1991, the high and low. And what we have here on the left column or the left axis is inches of precipitation. And on the lateral column, the horizontal axis, is from October 1st through September 30th. And what we always use as a water year, and the reason why we do that is because most of the groundwater recharge occurs from winter precipitation that straddles the calendar year.
So in hydrology, we always use the water year from October 1st to September 30th. So this shows, and it's basically a cumulative precipitation chart, which means we add the precipitation for every month until we get to the very end of the year. So each individual month is added to what was before, and then we can see how much we have at the end of the water year. And the dark blue line, that's the average water year, the average year for the whole calendar year. And you can see that comes up to a little bit over 6 inches. And this is the Red Rock Age at the Visitor Center. And the reason we use that is this has the longest period of record. And generally you can have a rain gauge at different spots and it's gonna maybe have a little different result depending on the intensity of the rain and how widespread it is. But what this shows is how things have changed over the year. And we also compare this to some of the snowtell, the more advanced precipitation stations that are up by Cow Canyon and Lee Canyon and those, as well as other stations in the area. But so this basically, yes, sir.
Yeah, well, Jim, you said you used a Red Rock Gauge, and I usually monitor that, the Blue Diamond North and the Blue Diamond South. Usually the Red Rock Gauge is usually at least 50% higher than the other two. Does that make a difference in the numbers?
Well, the main thing that we're looking for is what the actual groundwater levels are.
Okay.
So how these stations translate into what the water levels look like in the wells. So by looking at this other gauge, it's a remote automated weather station run by DRI. So it has a period of record going back to 1991. And we also look at a combined of all three gauges. But if we looked at how those change over the same period, there's drier periods and wetter periods, and even though the absolute number may be different, the relative changes are fairly similar, and especially how it relates to the changes in the wells. So even though if we had a rain gauge right here, it might be different from those ones, but generally in the drier years, that's going to be lower than what that average is if you're able to look at that over decades. And in wetter years, it's going to be wetter, and it's that relative difference. And mainly what is going on with the water levels in the wells is does that answer?
Yes, and just another quick question. On that very first page where it has the watershed there for Blue Diamond, is that basically, if you go underground, that's basically the aquifer? Or that is the area where that is drawing the water?
I have a geologic map that kind of shows that. In some areas, if there was not a lot of variability in geology, you usually have more similarities underground. Mm-hmm. But here, because of the variability in the rocks, I'll get to that in a couple of
slides. Oh, okay. So thank
that
you.
Might help the time.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that.
That sounds good.
Jim, so the Roz station here, this looks like the one that was behind the visitor center. Is that what?
Yes.
I thought they decommissioned that quite a long time ago.
This is still in operation. There's another one by by Spring Mountain Ranch that has been decommissioned in 2016.
Yeah, okay.
But this one it has, and I can give you if you want the link for that.
Yeah, I would appreciate that.
Then you can get actually the daily values there.
Yeah, yeah, I used to use it. I remember it went down though for some reason, and I thought it was gone. I'm going, wow, is it back? That's great. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
And there's other ones in the region too, and we compare it to looking at the bigger picture. But generally what occurs is these wetter periods throughout the area, especially in the Spring Mountains. It may not be exact from spot to spot, but mm-hmm. The wetter and drier years.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that are most of interest. And then I'll show you here in a little bit how we match those to the wells.
Thank you.
So basically this chart here, it also shows our highest, our wettest year in 2015 and our lowest in 2002. And also you see most of the precipitation, like in 2022, last year, we had a lot of precip in December, right around the holidays, and the rest of the year, it was very little. Where this year, because of a number of, as you're aware of, all the atmospheric rivers, what they call our Pineapple Express, mm-hmm. and other things that come in, that has given a tremendous amount of precipitation to the west. And so as we see here, we're above average for where we're at up to earlier this week. But in each of these, it's really until the end of March or into April that the majority of the winter precipitation occurs that's tied to the groundwater recharge. Once we get into summer and the monsoons, those tend to be more isolated versus precipitation falling over the whole area. And so those tend to be discounted because they also tend to evaporate or get taken up by like evapotranspiration, which is the plants taking up the moisture. But like last year, it was, if we get a number in a row, it's definitely good. And the other thing it does, it helps to basically rehydrate the soil moisture, because what happens after a series of dry years is the soil moisture dries up, the plants kind of go back into hibernation a little bit, and so it takes a little bit of additional moisture. It takes a fair amount to rehydrate that before that water can then pass through the shallow zone and into recharging the aquifer. And so when we do get a big wet year, the plants come back to life, and they're you know, especially the shallow root runs. But our best response happens when we get 2 years in a row where you get, you know, where it's spread out. So this is just a summary of the monthly averages, and where we're at right now. At that gauge, we're about 140% of what was the average for that gauge. So, but we could certainly, you know, apply that to all different gauges. I believe the up at Cow Canyon, those areas are much higher, but we do know that those are above average, right. Which is good. So let me just move to the next one. Now let's take a look at where we're at here. And this is the historical record back to 1994 for that particular gauge. So since it sort of normalizes the location, you can see, well, that's kind of like a surrogate for the rest of the area. So let's see how that's changed. And here we see in 2023, you know, we said we're about 130%. And then you can see as we move back in time, how dry 2021 was, 2022. And we had really four wet years over the last maybe 20 years, which is 2005, you can see it's over 300%, 2011, 2017, and 2019 were kind of the wettest ones. And the other landmark or benchmark that we have is that period from 2012 to 2016, where we had four years of really below normal. So that is a way of saying, okay, if we have these dry conditions, how does the aquifer respond? How do the wells respond? So we know if that repeats in the future, how is the system gonna react? So what we're able to do by looking at this is to say, okay, if we have these certain conditions within the historical range, how is the wells gonna react? How much of a reserve is there? How much of a buffer is there? And so that's what we want to look at the whole picture. So now we wanna take a look, okay, once we have rainfall going on the ground, what happens? What's the preferential pathway of that water to actually get to where our wells are? And so at first what happens is it runs off. It's almost like if you're watering a lawn, only so much goes on in the ground right before it starts running off. If you're pouring water on a plate versus a sponge, the lower transmissivity material runs off much easier. It doesn't soak in as like a sand or a gravel, right? So depending on what the infiltration rate or percolation rate is, that water, if there's too much rain too fast, it will just run off and run out of the watershed without infiltrating. The best situation is when you have a good snowpack and the snow slow melt or slow rain over a long period, because then instead of running off and running down the wash, it tends to soak in and infiltrate. So that's the ideal conditions for groundwater recharge. But so when we look, we have very complex geology in the area, as you're well aware. So, you know, as water falls down through precipitation, it moves through fractures in the rock, or it moves down through surface runoff to basically the alluvial fan or coarser material in front of the mountain front, and then it tends to soak in up to a point. And once it gets saturated or if it's too tight, that runs off, and then you can see it in the wash on a really high precipitation day moving out of the area. So that all comes together, and what we have on this one map, on a geology map, if you see this like lighter gray kind of line, it goes from the upper left-hand corner down past Blue Diamond, past where our wells are and off, that is basically a wash, we just call Cottonwood Wash. And so that's formed from before there were fractures and from a fault in the rocks that caused preferential erosion in that area. So water tend to move down there and move out, and it got filled in with cobbles and gravel. And with more faster water moving through, the finer grains move out, so it's coarser material. So as a result, if you have groundwater moving through bedrock, it moves very slow and it doesn't really move. It really needs to go through cracks or through coarser material. So the water moves down to this lower elevation and it moves through the wash, both on the surface as well as underground, following this pathway and then past where the wells are at and then out into the valley. So that's the primary in terms of the most transmissive aquifer. If you were to drill 20 wells throughout this whole area and see, okay, where are you going to get the best quality water and the highest yield? It's in this coarser material or in the upper part of the bedrock where there's more fractures. If you drill, just like in the 90s, they tried to do a test well in a park, right? And that only produced maybe not even 50 gallons a minute, and it had very poor quality, twice as much salinity than in the regular wells. Where our regular wells, you can pump 700 GPM. The one completed in the upper bedrock is about 300 GPM, where the park was only like 50. So depending on where you drill, you may not really get a lot of yield. So that's why those wells are there, and that's why the water moves through the system, if that all makes sense. Right? Mm-hmm. So now I just want to take a look, and if anybody's interested, I have the reference. This is page 1998, and it has a whole map for the whole area. It's a USGS publication that goes into more detail and probably a little clearer if you're interested in more of the geology. Mm-hmm. Are we doing okay for time?
Yeah.
And I just want to superimpose the town and the two wells. We call it the North Well, or JH from old when it was James Hardy, but JH and JHS, so we call it North and South Well. And then you can see where that's at in relation to the highway and the wash and the town and the water system. So just for reference. Now let's take a look now. Let's take a look at that same chart where we have the historical water level, precip levels. And it's the same thing that we looked before, where the wet years are. And then let's take a look, too, at where the static water levels, the wells aren't pumping, so they're not influenced by pumping, and how deep that water is. And that's just measured. We have a pressure transducer that measures how much column of water is above this, and that's recorded. Or you could take a tape and measure it. So you could go down and remeasure it, and you would get this. And so we basically have hourly measurements for almost the last 18 years or so, and now it's even more often. So you can see we have the North Well, which is the darker blue, and the South Well, and they respond together because they're completed pretty similar depths. But you can see how much of a difference and how much of an influence the big recharge events have on the water levels and how important they are. So in 2005, when there was that large event, there was an increase of close to 15 feet. And the record's pretty poor before 2005, but at least gives a rough idea of what we got. And then what's interesting is when you have this dry period, from each period, there's a wet period in 2005, 2011, you can see that recharge has occurred. And then more recently in 2017 and the water year 2019. And both of those, we got almost a 10-foot rise as this water moves through the system. And then once that recharge pulse moves through, we can see from right after 2005, and then from 2011 to 16, and then from 2020 to now, you see that slope of the line is about 3 foot a year of drop. So we know that you have all this water throughout the area. It's kind of being held back by the geologic materials, and it drains out at about 3 feet a year, translates into those water levels at our wells. So in the future, when we get a recharge pulse, we can say, okay, we know as long as it's within this range of history, we know that the geologic system is going to respond with about a 3 foot drop a year, and which helps to manage everything. Of concern is when we get extended drought, and because of the susceptibility, because of the small saturated thickness of the aquifer and limited extent, it's susceptible to these dry periods. And that's why these wet periods are so valuable to reset the system, basically.
How long does it take after precipitation for the groundwater to recharge?
So generally we see like a inflection point of change. So we have the downward slope, and then depending if there's snow melts earlier in the year, we see different things. But right around now, and what we saw just recently was about 2 to 3 weeks ago, where we've seen about a foot and a half change right now. And then it usually goes on through about June, depending on how intense that recharge pulse is. So right now we'd want to look at it over the next 3 months, 2 to 3 months. And depending on how intense the storm or the recharge pulse is, it kind of says how strong it is. Now in the past, it's always been a little more about where we've seen 130 to 140%, where we've seen a real definitive recharge pulse. So right now, if we can see what happens this summer, or not this summer, this tonight, I guess, and tomorrow, and then the next couple of weeks, then we will watch this to see how much of this recharge pulse, and as long as it keeps moving up, certainly every drop is valuable, and every foot. But then once we see in June, as you can see on here, in 2011, it started to the peak right around May to June, you know, where the top of the peak was.
Mm-hmm.
The same in 2017. We had that winter of 16 to 17, and that peaked about in summer, and the same. So we would foresee something similar like that occurring, and then we would know back in a couple months where we're at. But what the good part is every foot that we have move up, we know that even if we get drier conditions, we have this, we can estimate, at least within this range, how the water will drop and then take, you know, actions accordingly.
So this is like 2 or 3 months, or is it 6 months that it takes? Like from the hypothetical first drop of rain for this pulse, let's say.
So let's say we start to see it revealing itself or start showing up in a well around in March. So for everything in the winter, a lot depends on if there's a big snowpack and that hasn't melted yet. That's a little later because it takes time for that mm-hmm. to go through. So right around now it starts, or right around, I'd say like 2 weeks ago it starts, and that would extend through probably May to June, mm-hmm. depending on how much actually translates, because we don't know how much has been taken up by mm-hmm. the dry soil conditions, how much of the precip has run off and mm-hmm. is beyond the capture zone of the wells. You know, when there's a big rain event, that's sort of lost to the groundwater system because... Mm-hmm.
But at some level, the surface soil gets wet and it percolates all the way down to the water table?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. correct. And depending where it's at, you know, once that saturates, it continues there. But there's other fractures in the bedrock and so forth where it's more direct.
I see.
And there's more direct routes or anything that is in the wash area. That's all direct, and that's what we see, now. So mm-hmm. that's why it takes over this long period. It's not an instantaneous event. Uh-huh. Plus, we get water from the far reaches of the watershed, which has a longer lag time and longer travel time than something maybe that just falls like right here, or let's say the discharge from Cottonwood Spring that moves out and infiltrates in the alluvial materials.
It's fascinating that this is actually knowable.
Well, and to having the record, and I think that's the key thing, is as long as the record is within the range of history, we know geologically how things are going to be. It's just when we get beyond that we have to be very cautious because we don't know the full geometry of the aquifer, you know, especially since it's a wash. What happens when it gets lower is all of a sudden it narrows down or not. But we have high confidence in if it stays within that range. And that's why we have to be very careful if we get longer extended droughts and we get there, as to how the aquifer will respond.
Thank you. I have one more question, which is you're talking about a 3 foot a year drawdown that can be depended on. Is that just usage, or is there also an outflow?
So that's just outflow. That's independent of usage. Oh, that's just looking from this. So you figure it's almost like, you know, we have a sand. Let's say we have a tub of sand and we're pouring it in, and we pour so much water in and it's restricted. So it's only allowing so much water out. And then we see, okay, we pour X amount in. And then whatever happens, we have this little straw in there to know where it's at. That's dropping at a certain rate. So regardless, I mean, if there's a lot of, I think as we get lower and lower water levels, it becomes more important to demand and so forth. But when we just have these recharge pulses, there's this water moving out through the wash past our wells.
Mm-hmm.
And we can capture a portion of that. But generally, whether... the system's going to behave a certain way, and that much water right. is going
to
drain off.
So we need to think of it as like an underground water course, like a river or a stream or something.
In this case, yes. I mean, most of the time you don't want to relate groundwater to rivers or surface water activities, but because it's a surface wash, because it's a shallow wash, it sort of behaves in a lot of ways like it,
mm-hmm.
because it's water coming in, and it's all through these cobbles and boulders moving through. And then it only allows so much water to pass through it. And as that goes down, there's more base flow that comes in from the bedrock and so forth to continue that.
Thank you.
That makes sense.
Appreciate mm-hmm. that.
So then I just wanted to move up here real quick to the next page. And that's if anybody just wanted to see the absolute values of how much water versus percent of normal. So this just basically says the exact... value, and this is winter, so through the end of March, so it's half of the water year when most of the recharge occurs. And the first diagram that shows the whole calendar year, just so that doesn't get confused. Mm-hmm. So it's just another way of portraying it. Now, if we take this now, and then let's superimpose this on the construction of the wells and what the aquifer properties are at, where the two wells are at. Here we have basically a schematic of the north well and south well. So the wash is about 60 feet, well, actually about 58 feet deep, if you were to drill down before you hit fractured bedrock. And the north well is completed fully in the unconsolidated material with the cobbles and the gravel. The south well originally was completed across both, but that's mainly because the wells are fairly old.
Which diagram are you referring to?
I'm sorry. These on the right here. So these are the two wells. And so the south well is completed more in the upper part of the bedrock. And that's interesting because we actually see more flow in the more yield in that upper zone. So that shows that's the most transmissive zone is that base of the wash. Now in 2017, these wells are fairly old. So in 2017, we relined the well, right? So that reduced the efficiency of it a bit, but it's still a very functional well. But the north well is the primary well that's used, and the south well is the backup if there's a problem with the south well. And we actually just retested that in December, that can produce over 300 gallons a minute. We just want to make sure the well is still functional.
And when you say realigned, that means drilled in another place?
So the north well, what happened is the well was getting so old it was corroding, so some of the geologic material was coming
in. Actually, you relined it.
And then we put a liner in to stabilize it because it was...
I misheard you. I thought you said realigned, and I...
And then when we look back, and we basically set the pumps at the base of the well. So here's where the actual pump intakes are.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an idea, and that's where the lines are here on the graph. Yeah. And basically what we took here, what's on the left side here, where it says historical water levels for North and South Well, the upper line is the same static water level that we showed on the other map, right? So that's if we're not pumping at all, right? And that's where our water levels, you see the four major recharge events. And then below that, darker blue, that's the pumping level when we pump the north well at 700 gallons a minute. So you can see there's about 10 feet of drawdown. That would be referred to as drawdown, is how much the well drops. And you can also see is we were pumping the same rate pretty much through this whole period. And you can see after it was lined, all of a sudden, instead of about 5 feet of drawdown from before 2017, it's like 10 feet because it's not as efficient a well because it has a liner in it. But we're still about 20 feet or so above the intake. And then the other figure is the south well, and the other, that's pumping level when that's pumped at 300 gallons a minute. You can see that has like 20 feet of drawdown, so it's not as efficient of a well, but it's still functional. So the thing we want to make sure of is that we have a sufficient buffer above that intake to make sure that there's always a reliable water supply. And then we superimpose what we've learned before about, how's the aquifer behaving? And then from there, we can all say, okay, well, here's where we have most concern. Here's where we know we have confidence in what's going, what the water levels are going to be. So we've also done testing where instead of right now, the pump turns on about 60 times a day at 700, but we could also just run it continuously at a lot less, and we don't get as much drawdown. So that if water levels continue to drop, that would be the first thing is to change the pumping strategy. So that automatically builds another 3 to 6 feet of less drawdown. So with that, it sort of gives the bigger picture of where we're at now. And then we could just see, now we get this recharge pulse and hopefully it's significant. Hopefully we get another one and, we're getting more recharge in. And if we get a second year in a row, we would expect to see more of that water going into recharge versus the soil moisture. And then from there, we can superimpose a slope and say, okay, here's what we would expect to see, and here's how many years we have of before we need to be at this concern level or this concern level for the well operation. And then separate to this is the whole idea of trying to get a new well, a backup well from the Corps of Engineers that's very efficient, so we get very little drawdown. One with a more advanced screen design from when it was in the 60s. And that, when the static wouldn't change, but the amount of drawdown for the same amount of water would be a lot less, giving us a bigger bumper. So that's sort of the overall game plan and the idea. So does that make sense, then? Is there any questions on this? So now the next step is, we're doing good for time, is, we know there's a lot of trends and there's a lot of documentation of warmer climate and warmer events, especially in the west, right? Colorado is a big concern, right? And how does that affect our precip, we're going to see how that's going to affect the water resources. So when we plan out 50 years, or, you know, that's usually our window, is the next decades. What are we going to need? You know, will there be a water supply? What happens if we have 10 years of below normal? We have to have a plan in mind so that it's fortunate and bless everything that we get these recharge events. But let's say we didn't get the event in 2017 or 19. You know, we project out, well, where would this water be? And then we have to take contingencies from that point. But when we look, so what we've done as an organization is there's these global climate projection models, and a lot of them tell, there's a lot of variability in them, but what we've tried to do is narrow those down and see how does it affect Clark County and how does it affect the Spring Mountains specifically. And so what we had, Scripps Institute did a kind of help or prepared this, and we looked at and go, okay, here's the best models that apply to conditions in Southern Nevada. And then most of them all show that we can expect increase in temperature, especially nighttime temperatures, over the next several decades. And we've actually seen that in the weather stations. And it's like, well, how does that affect how the recharge occurs in our water resources? And then they've also showed that the precip was mixed, that there wasn't really a downtrend or uptrend, but you have to take a model with a little bit of a grain of salt until you can prove it, that it matches. But moving that out, let's say we do get several degrees of additional warming of temperature. How does that affect production of the wells and the water resources? And I just listed this out, and basically, they've been studying this throughout the West, you know, especially the effect of fires on it, and also of dust, more dust on the air getting on the snowpack and so forth. And generally what the models seem to all point to is that we, and these are all things that just for consideration, we have to see, you know, we have to always consider a worst case. And it's increase in temperature trend, especially nighttime lows, and that may shift the snow melt and groundwater recharge dynamics, may shift. And by that, the fall and spring seasons may be longer, and the winter season may be lower, and there might be a higher elevation of snowpack. And it's not as critical, let's say, for Kyle Canyon, where it's way up, but here, it's very important that we get the snowpack, and that really is the essence of the main recharge sources, snowpack and snow melting. Then on the next page, there's maybe more of a shift to rain versus snow. So some of the snowpack that there may wash away, and if it's too intense, that water, instead of recharging, may end up as runoff. And a faster snowmelt because of warming may result in more surface runoff, less infiltration. And also increase in slow sublimation. What sublimation is if you put an ice cube on a cold day on a porch, and you go back the next day or later on, all of a sudden the ice cube is much skinnier, but there's no meltwater anywhere, and that's just the vapor, basically it moves into the atmosphere, and especially in arid areas in the West. So that's a common issue for snowpack, both in the Rocky Mountains and here in the Spring Mountains.
Doesn't that just return as rain now?
Like it would. I mean, once it's in there, if it's enough condensation, it would replace somewhere, whether it would be here or another place. So, and higher evaporative transpiration, if it's warmer, longer summers, there's more plant evaporation. And so you can picture even like the vegetation along the wash, that needs to use water from somewhere, and that takes water from the soil moisture.
I think we kind of see that every August, basically, with the afternoon thunderstorms that are recharged by evaporation in the morning, basically.
Yes, absolutely. It's right there. You can see the condensation occurring, and then it basically recycled back. So in summary, just for our summary and water resource outlook, there's a hydrologic and well performance monitoring program in place. So there are precip stations around the region to document what is occurring. And there's more, it seems, especially at higher elevations, to improve that and improve models. And having our continued measurements of the wells that are in town here, we also monitor BLM monitor well just down the road. It's down gradient of the site, and there we see the same recharge pulses too. Water year 2023, of course, characterized by above normal precip and atmospheric river events. And Blue Diamond wells, they're operating in the historical range near the low end of them. But we should expect this summer to see a recharge pulse. How intense it'll be, we'll see in the next couple months. But as long as we're operating within this known range, we can better predict what to expect And then if we break out of this range on a low end, that's where we have to be very attentive to changes. And then water, groundwater levels are primarily affected by infiltration and winter precip, with a recharge pulse observed when we have significant above normal precip. And then long-term groundwater levels, they remain uncertain because we just don't know when these recharge events are going to occur, or will we end up with multiple dry years in a row that we have to prepare for. And then the mountain alluvial aquifers are vulnerable to extended dry years.
When you say alluvial aquifers, obviously talking about things that are being recharged by rain up high in the mountains. Is that
yes, I mean by alluvial aquifers, it's mainly it's like a stream bed. So like the wash, I would say. Basically the wash aquifer that we have is alluvial, just meaning like it was derived from a
stream. I have a question about the, so the water year goes from October through September, is that right?
Correct, yeah. October 1st.
Now, yes. So in October of 22, the water year for 2023 began.
That's correct.
That's the way you refer to it.
Yes.
Okay.
And then that way we can capture the entire winter event. And then when you're looking at a record and you say, well, there was this much precip, you don't know, well, was that left over from last year? Or so usually that's why the hydrology usually always use water years for that. So.
Thank you. So
was there any other questions for us?
How effective are cloud seeding programs?
What's that? I'm sorry?
Cloud seeding.
So with that, it's certainly every ounce, every drop of water is excellent, you know, because it adds to the precip events. So cloud seeding, it improves the efficiency of a rain event. So first you have to have the rain event there. So in these drier years, 2020, 2021, 2022, last 2 years, there wasn't many rain events, so the cloud seeding couldn't be used. But for these type of events, they're excellent. They usually is from 5 to 15% additional efficiency. So the question always is, on a blanket scale, it affects it. Whether it falls specifically in this watershed, you'd have to evaluate that to see, well, how much of the cloud seeding is falling around the area, and you probably could add certainly more, you know, with this. And you know, as it falls through the watershed, it certainly helps by far, and certainly up in Kyle Canyon, absolutely. There's the generator in Mount Potosi. The storms have to be arranged and moving a certain direction to at most benefit this, but it certainly adds, every bit helps. I don't know if you wanted to add anything else with that.
In terms of, well, you know, we have the cloud seeder that we're funding to save Red Rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they have added 6,000 acre feet of water through over the Red Rock Canyon. So that's a lot of water.
Wow.
So I know what part of it, too, is, you know, I'm not sure quite how it's derived and everything, but, you know, so with some of it is, you know, in terms of groundwater, too, is how much is transferred into, you know, infiltration and so forth like that. But it's certainly, you know, in terms of the soil moisture and everything else, you know, and but I think as long as we have snow events and big events, then it's effective. But without the events, without having these wetter years where we have the storms moving through, then we're still faced with problems where it's very dry. Yeah.
Is there any advantage of putting like a retention system in the Lower Cottonwood Springs to keep the water there and have it infiltrate down?
Well, certainly there's managed aquifer recharge that occurs that we set up like in like for stormwater runoff. It'd just be how much can be held back for how long a period of time. You know, they tend to be so short-lived, and access in a conservation area might be difficult, you know, getting property access.
Where are the wellheads are on private land, so
yes,
there's that possibility over there by what we call the Lower Cottonwood Springs or the Cottonwood Springs riparian area.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a way to have a reservoir to hold back as much water as possible, I think part of the issue would be is when it's actually flowing is a fairly limited period of time, so whatever would hold back before that water would infiltrate in, it would help, I think, a limited amount, but it's also exposed that water flows over that entire wash, so it's infiltrating all along.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it certainly wouldn't hurt, mm-hmm. but it would just be a question of how much would it help, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely in other places in California, they're doing more, trying to retain more runoff instead of getting into the ocean, you know, and then they can try to infiltrate them.
It used to be like up at the Upper Cottonwood Springs, there was a retention system up there to hold the water. That kind of just deteriorated over time. I don't know who put it in, but it used to work.
Yeah, I think a part of it would be is how much, they almost have to do a feasibility study to see, you know, how what period of time would operate and how much would actually infiltrate, and then, you know, trying to arrange for the access, you know, so.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any more questions or comments?
That was my question, was just if there were opportunities to increase the retention somehow, if there were creative options that hadn't been tried yet.
Yeah, I think too, if there was more, I think it might be difficult on Red Rock, the conservation area, but that definitely is throughout the West, looking at these options of saying, okay, it's certainly if we can slow it down and have some, it's certainly some amount that can move in and be able to infiltrate. And then sometimes they're like managed, so it's sometimes they're less sediment sometimes carried in, they get kind of silted in, so it reduces the infiltration rate, but it has to be actively kind of scarified or ripped up so that there's additional water that can move in through it. But yes.
All that water that goes down in the wash and all that water that comes out of the spring, does that make it into the aquifer or does it keep going?
So it depends on how much is flowing in there. If it's just a little bit, that's fairly coarse material, so as it's moving through, there's a lot of recharge that's occurring, but it still has a upper point. And when it's flowing fast, a lot of that water basically just flows down. And I think it eventually infiltrates down and goes into the flood system if it's too much. But the water, the best situation is when there's a little bit of water coming out or there's lower flow, and then that mainly infiltrates in because it's in that riverbed, it's very coarse material that's in there. But once it,
so would it be out of, not realistic or a thought to just create a detention basin at the end of that wash and where this cotton, to give the crown enough time to absorb it instead of just letting it go down somewhere where it doesn't become usable? Cause you don't have, like you said, this is a unique situation here. We only have so much, you know, so much area to capture, and if you let it keep going, you know, the days, like the winters like you had now, where that thing's been running, and I've noticed it run 4 or 5 times this year alone with a lot of water. And, you know, it'd be nice to be able to collect it. How hard is that way to collect it?
Well, one of the issues is once it's infiltrated, the groundwater still moves underground at a rate. So even if we infiltrate it in, let's say we put a big reservoir or a wall, let's say we're a wall and we back it up. Once it gets in the aquifer, it's still going to move through the aquifer downhill. You know, so part of the evaluation would have to be, okay, so let's say we have this retention pond, that water comes, what's the fate of that water that infiltrates? And what we see is, you know, part of that 3-foot drop per year is that water moving through the aquifer out past the capture zone of the well. So I don't know if it would really help us that much unless, you know, we were pumping so much, was pumping out, that it would add to it. So I think what would happen, if you put that retention pond in, it would infiltrate more in, but that water would then move past the wells. And
that's okay. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
I kind of thought
that's Mother Nature doing its job.
Gigi, I thought you were kind of asking if we could do it onto the underground water, if we could retain it at the underground level.
No, it's just surface water. Above ground water. Well, let it sink underground. Yeah. Let it do its thing underground. That's great. Above ground just tends to evaporate and get absorbed through washes and in the desert, you know.
Because we have the retention basin, that retention basin down by where Summerlin is, that of course is our one stop for the water that's flowing on the surface level, right?
There is a retention basin down there?
Huh?
At the
Swiss Skid Road.
The
Yeah, by Skid Row.
Oh, yeah, but that doesn't come in.
I think that's really mostly designed to prevent a flood from hitting town.
That's flood control.
I'm talking about this water that flood control. Down.
Yeah, flood control. Yeah.
All it is.
We're in that wash.
Does the underground aquifer water flow, is it stopped from further soaking in by a bedrock layer of some sort?
So it's basically, it's like, let's say if you picture it like this,
okay.
we're surrounded by bedrock on these two sides, so there's still some groundwater movement through the bed, but it's very low because it's so tight. So it kind of flows down this channel, and then once it gets past our wells and it moves out, the wash opens up more. Mm-hmm. So then there's no bedrock. The bedrock is much deeper. Okay. So that basically flows into, like when you have all the wells along Blue Diamond Road, it basically recharges that, you know, and it moves down.
And I have a comment on this. Given the nature of how the recharge works and what we know about it, I think that's why we are, when I say we, meaning Save Red Rock, are such fans of the cloud seeder technology, because the people, I think, believe, well, 5 to 15%, what more is that? But the key is, if we're, you know, just doing a little bit at a time, like the tortoise beats the hare in this scenario, we need more over a longer period of time, not big, huge, violent weather events that often just cause flooding and don't recharge the aquifer at all. And so what I'm hearing is we have one now, that's great. The second thing that you were saying was, getting cloud seeding specifically in this area is a little challenging, and that is also something that we've been fighting to do. And we've actually have a partnership with VRI where we were able to position one that specifically goes over this aquifer, which, to be quite frank, we didn't really think, like, Las Vegas generally has no reason to want to put one there because it's not going to be feeding the main water source of most of their customers. So we had that in play in addition to the just ecological sensitivity of this area and keeping the plants and animals healthy. And then the third thing I want to say is just the multi-year thing, which Jim was talking about, where if we do this for 1 year and then walk away, well, that's not as effective as now that the groundwater is saturated, doing it again next year and again the year after and again the year after, so that we're continually allowing that recharge to take place over time. So from our perspective, I just wanted to put that in your consciousness so that you're aware of, like, this being an extremely effective strategy that we're hoping to get a little bit more widespread support on.
And every bit helps too, you know, it's like, especially, you know, let's say there is drier years, there's only a few storms, to have that little bit extra for the plants in Red Rock, and because it's getting the water to the topsoil, that is so critical, and that is it doesn't help the wells, but it helps the topsoil and everything else, you know. So,
and over time, it will help the wells, because in the next, you know, season, if it's a little higher than normal, now that the ground is saturated, you're going to see that full infiltration. So this is a long game, and it's a slow play, and we, you know, think that that's an effective strategy. That, you know, if anyone has any questions, let us know, because we are working with the best scientists in the world on that.
So one more question. Is there any, like, estimate or an idea how much of a 3-foot drawdown a year is affected by just nature, you know, or by consumption? You know, is there any idea that is it people consume that, or is it like it would be regardless, you know, we'll get those if we just stop using anything?
Well, I think part of it is how close we are to the recharge. Plus, when one first moves through, I think most of that is natural. Let's say there is no wells, no pumping. We're going to get a natural decline in that water, because all of a sudden we reset the system, and it's like everything's draining out through the area. As the water levels get lower and lower, production and water use becomes more critical. It's a more of a contributor to that, especially when we get to lower levels. That is when conservation is always important, but it becomes more critical when we're at the lower range of the water levels. That makes sense, because we're getting a lot of water moving through the system. That's going to flow out no matter what. It's just when we get down and there's less water moving through the system, then the percent we're pulling out by production is greater than, you know, becomes a bigger element to it.
Right. So, for example, you know, like I think, you know, like, let's say gray water systems or something, is it something that can recharge aquifer rather than being in a sewer. You know, I know it's like, this is not, you know, in Clark County, this, because everything comes from Lake Mead, goes back to Lake Mead, that's how it is. But here, when it comes from here, it goes to Lake Mead, you know, through our sewers, you know. It's not recharging back our aquifer because we don't have that system.
Yeah, I think part of it too is the groundwater quality element of the two.
Right.
Is because the wells are so close, like that there were septic systems and not, you know, sanitary sewer, there would be more recharge, but there would also be the associated degradation from the septic systems.
And so water is way less treated, so that's part of the problem here. So you can't treat that water heavily and then bring it back in the way they do.
Our water use, most of it's not going to be in the ponds, because I think about 75% of it's used for landscaping.
Yeah.
So that only 25%, which say we use 100 acre feet of water, there's about 25 acre feet that would end up in this treatment pond. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's not that much.
Sounds good. Anything else that?
I had a supply and demand question, so economics, and it's along the side of demand. If I'm looking at this chart, so we're losing 3 feet, but it seems like our usage is about the same, right, over time.
Yes, actually, if you combine the use of the certain teeth, you know, that has the wells. You know, we're actually lower than we were in the 90s, you know, in the mid-2000s and 90s, I believe. So, you know, because they've reduced the amount of water they're using to some degree from last decade or from a decade and a half ago. So,
okay, so the usage in the town sounds to me like, even though we're using less water, And it makes sense to use. I mean, I have no landscaping left, and I'm not going to put any more in. But it's not a demand issue, right? It's a supply issue.
Well, I think part of it too is it depends on where we're at on the chart. As we get closer to lower water levels, the demand is more critical. You know, if we break, let's say, below this level as we get down to lower water levels, just what the wells can, you know, produce as we get closer and closer to.
But our usage is 2 feet, basically, right? Because we're losing 5 feet a year on a low rain year or low snowpack year, right? So it's just been, it's three feet out the door, 2 feet outer sprinklers. And it's been like that, or it might be, certainty might be helping that. I mean, they're reducing their usage, but it seems like that's basically where we're at. And because of climate change or reduced production, then that would be, it's not that we're, I guess it's, I'm looking at it as like, we're not really wasting water more. It's just that there's not as much.
Yeah, it's definitely a supply. Right? I mean, the underlying factor is a reliable supply. I think, you know, is that if we knew that we had, you know, every 2 years a recharge event, then I think there's more confidence that the system will function. I think what the biggest concern would be is if we don't have these recharge events over a number of years and it goes beyond that, then it taxes the system the way it is. And as we get, I think, lower and lower aquifer levels, the conservation becomes even more critical, because then it's, because one thing we don't know quite is, once we get down below, I think the lowest
was
23 feet, and now we're up. But once we get below 23 feet, is the aquifer, we know how it behaves up here, but when we're down here, is it like this? Or, you know, and all of a sudden we drop off. And that's why having a conservation program in place is very critical. Now, if we were able, by the Corps of Engineers, to be able to do the investigation for the wells, one of the things we want to do is a geophysical survey to see what's the contact of the bedrock in the wash and understand that better. Mm-hmm. And I think as there's more confidence in that, then we know, okay, there's plenty of reserve, then we can be, we don't have to be as conservative with it. But I think once one of these lower areas, it's important. I don't know, Derek, if there's anything else you want to add on that?
No, that's right. I mean, I think you're asking, or I think maybe a simpler way to say, I mean, if you're asking what impacts the aquifer level more, Mother Nature or water conservation? And I think Jim has explained that water conservation is critical, especially as we reach those lower levels. But if you're looking as to what has stronger influence over the aquifer levels, it's the amount of
precipitation falls.
So we're not going to see the any new water meters anytime soon, obviously.
Right? No, we're not going to see any what?
New meters.
New services.
New services, right? Yeah. I mean, because if we're losing 3 feet just naturally, and it doesn't, I mean, we're drawing down 2 feet.
That's correct.
Yeah, we're kind of at a...
getting close to the end here.
Yeah, we're getting close to the end.
We're definitely on a hard pause.
The uncertainty, too. I mean, if we knew that, okay, you know, especially with the climate conditions, right. It's like pointing towards we're going to have tougher conditions in the future 10 years out. And certainly anything new, you want to be able to have the resources for it. So I think that's kind of the dilemma a little bit is if there was more consistency in new that we're going to get X amount, then there's a lot more to work with, mm-hmm. You know.
I just want to clarify, you know, we're talking about 3 feet that we're
losing. Could you speak up a little bit, please?
No, just want to clarify, 3 feet, and where did this 5 feet come from, anyway?
Yeah, so 3 feet is what the record shows.
It's a record of consumed and Mother Nature altogether. That's what...
The 5 feet is, yeah.
No, they're 3 feet.
Just well, I mean, if I'm looking at this chart, it's going down 5 feet on a practically a 0 year.
Okay,
well, so I mean, you're saying 3 feet is Mother Nature, and I'm assuming that it's 2 feet.
Right, let me just explain more. So, like, if you look at a 10-foot drop, you know, over, let's see, how many years? Over, like, 3 years. So we look, like, from 2013 to 16,
yeah.
We have about a 10-foot drop, so about 3 foot a year. That's how I can look at the 3 feet.
Okay, so is that static, or is that active?
That's with static.
Okay.
That's what's there. So I think roughly we're in these periods when we look at the slope, we're about that
3 feet.
Yeah, but that was before you did any conservation.
Well,
there was no conservation back then compared to now.
Right. I mean, I think that's just the combined. That's just what the historical record has shown in the past.
Well, especially when they conserve 2 million gallons, mm-hmm. like they're proposed, like they're boasting,
yeah,
if
yeah.
they save 2 million gallons, what does that relate to in feet?
Feet of
the
static.
How do we calculate
yeah.
that?
Yeah, it's a little tougher because it's complicated because of the different depths. The aquifer is responding differently to how much water is pulled out. And it's kind of a combination of not only what is coming in, it's like what we're pulling out through the wells, but what's draining naturally. So it's sort of tough to...
Well, I think what we can say is just what is. Like, we have saved that many gallons of water, but the well levels are still dropping. So it's not a net gain. It's still a net loss. Yeah.
The conservation...
Well, also remember, we saved 2 million, but also people added 2 million.
We did, right.
So we were in
this year, but the year before, we did a save
yeah.
of 2 million purely, but the well level still dropped year over year. This year, we still had a well level drop at the rate that Jim's talking about, with, you know, not as many gallons saved net, because we did have adders. And then we had some, you know, events. There were some leaks, there were some other things, you know. We're hoping that it stabilizes even a little bit more with the new pipes as well, because we had no way of measuring how much of that pipeline was leaking for the whole time. So,
too, what we see in the winter months is that the slope kind of levels off, and when we have like average or below, it's not quite as steep in the winter. It's like the aggregate over time.
Mm-hmm.
But the things I can't tell is that because we're using less water in winter from less
mm-hmm.
irrigation, or is it because there's less evapotranspiration
mm-hmm.
from the plants
mm-hmm.
during that period?
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think that it's from absolutely. I like to think it's from the conservation because
yeah.
there's not as much, you know, plant usage of water. But
well,
trying
know
to
how much they save,
yeah,
you go through
yeah.
the meter.
Yeah, no, we know that, but I mean, in terms of the water levels changing in the wells, if that's all from conservation, or if that's also because the plants along the wash are taking less
mm-hmm.
of the supply,
yeah.
you know, and so we think it's driven by conservation during that, but it's, you can't, you know, for sure say definitively.
Mm-hmm.
So the solution is you got to bring a pipe. Or, we need to, you're not going to be able to, if you're fighting uphill, if the level keeps
right.
going down, you get rain like this, and it keeps dropping, then the only solution is bring in another source of water.
Well, there's different contingencies that you go through, and you go, well, at first, as long as we have recharge events occurring, we stay within this range, we know everything is very reliable. We also have a pretty good buffer and we could change the pumping strategy of the well, so we can pump less, and that builds three or four feet less. There's also, if a new, more efficient well, backup well, is put in, that is even more efficient of a well. So we know the thing we want to do is maximize that buffer and do everything we can to reduce, either through conservation or through the well hydraulics, better well hydraulics, more efficient well. I mean, if let's say we didn't get another raindrop for 20 years, I mean, at some point, you know, we're dependent upon these winter events occurring. So it's just a matter of, will they occur at the frequency we've seen over the last 20 years and before that? Or is it something where we won't see another event for 10 years? But as this occurs, we know the system drops so much, so we have time to say, okay, we're at this contingency, we're at this trigger. We hit this trigger, well, then we change the pumping strategy. We hit this, then we see, you know, what is there. And I don't know if you, anything else you guys want to
add? No, I mean, yeah, every water system that we operate has an emergency plan. As a water utility, obviously, we don't generally disclose the details and minutia of our emergency plans. But, I mean, there is an emergency plan in place for Blue Diamond, just like there is for the Water District and Kyle Canyon. And it is correlated to the levels at the wells, as well as the condition of the wells. And depending on the severity of the emergency, yeah, I mean, it ranges from everything from if the community literally is running out of water to trucking water up here on a temporary basis, or as an absolute last-ditch effort, yeah, having to run up a temporary pipeline to help supplement the community's water supply.
Well, and our, as conservationists and neighbors, our goal, hopefully, is we work together properly that we never have to see that day. You know, I mean, to be honest, we've really only been in a concerted, collaborative effort of conserving for, like, 3 to 5 years, right? So, I mean, because you're right, nobody was even following a watering schedule before we sort of organized in that way. So I'd love to see what's possible over the next 5 years of both conservation and adding precipitation to the aquifer, and then let's see where we are in 3 years, but I think we can do it.
And we are working to, here in the next year, so sure. We are working to revise the service rules to include requirements for watering days and watering schedules and additional water conservation efforts, water waste penalties. So we're moving forward with that.
Yeah, we maybe just had a tiered watering system here in this village a year ago.
Yep.
So we're, all of those are steps towards this, you know, saving this water in a way where we can conserve it and have it last a lot longer than it will, by what this chart says.
Knowing that there's these different levels of action too, you know, by having a second well, having the south well that's deeper. And, you know, the town, you know, if things come, you know, we would agree with certainty as the town has a priority if there's, if there's a major issue. And so not only do we have the shallower, we have the deeper well that we have more than what the town needs. You know, so it gives plenty of time to make these adjustments. Plus, by monitoring this all the time, it gives some time to see, you know, what's happening with the climate, what's happening, you know, with storms. But I think, you know, we're, you know, from just based on the last 20 years, I think it's characterized that we're going to have these wet years followed by extended periods of drought for several years, you know, and you know, it's just that there's not such a shift that we don't get big events, but everything seems to point towards, you know, these small events occurring. So we'll see how it goes. But we have to be prepared for different contingencies.
The water truck.
So, everybody else with
I got something.
Any other questions?
Yes. Yeah. Years ago, Pauline will know this. Megan will know this. We had discussions. They were NDOT was pulling water out of down by Cactus Joe's. If you're familiar,
yes.
Down there. And so we got John Guillory involved in it, and there was talk about Blue Diamond being on one aquifer, and down that way was another aquifer. And my question would be, since Red Rock, our board, we represent Calico Basin, do they have their own aquifer versus the Blue Diamond aquifer, and also along 160 going down towards Wallapai, like where are how many aquifers are there basically?
So Calico is they most have their own wells, and that's a separate the watershed, so they get recharged right nearby. That water eventually flows out to the north,
okay,
and out that way. So you can kind of see on here where kind of the divide is, and then it's basically a similar type of sediment, though. I mean, you have, you know, basically it's erosional sediment from the mountains that fills in, and then a wash that basically carries that water out. But so they're they have their own private wells. Most of those homes have their own private wells, and so it's basically it's separate. The source water is separate because they're out of the watershed.
But what about going down towards Cactus Joe's, where John Guillory was saying, and he had written that was a separate aquifer over there, yeah. And then also along 160. What about that?
So so the wash from here that eventually ties into all the other erosional debris from the mountains that fill Las Vegas Valley. So the underground water there basically, I would say, Coleman's. I have to look closer, basically,
okay.
Cactus Joe's. And Arden Pipeline and so forth like that, because it's how he's tied, if he is. I'm not sure if he's tied into there or not, or if he had his own well.
Well, the Arden Pipeline is coming out of the park.
Here.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure if he was on there. But we do monitor and have monitored wells that are down there, and we do see the recharge pulse. And it's not just from our watershed, but also from other parts, from other areas. And you see in spring the same thing happening, moving down to those erosional sediments. In that area by Cactus Joe's. I'd have to look more into that. And John, he's, you know, they have more of the overall responsibility for the overall water rights, so he's probably more familiar with that than I am.
And then the other thing was, I live roughly 1 mile up from Mollapai, and when one of the well guys was there for another house, I asked him, I said, they were pulling the pump out. So I said to him, I said, can you tell me what the water level is there? Because our pump is basically just next door, 100 yards away. So he said 380 feet. Now, our well, last time it was, they went down with the scoping down there, was 480. And so I said, really? I said, we're only that far away. And the well driller said, Las Vegas Valley Water District was pumping water into a lot of the aquifers. Is there any truth to that?
So there's an artificial recharge program from 1989 to about 2011, and that was taking excess water from the Colorado River, but that was all mainly put in up on the northwest side of the valley where the sediments are more transmissive. The sediments in the south are tighter, generally. You know, you don't get the yield. So there was an artificial recharge program of excess treated Colorado River water, but it was mainly up in that area. And part of it, I think we see rising water levels in different parts of the valley from even residual from when there was less pumping, people not pumping their wells as much or replaced with Colorado River water. And I think just less stress on the aquifers there. But we are seeing water levels increasing across the valley. Especially in the northeast, mm-hmm. I think because Nellis isn't pumping their wells,
okay.
And there. But I might have to look closer because okay. I don't have as many monitor wells, mm-hmm. you know, right up there. The only things we have is just at the bottom of the near the Blue Diamond Road. There's one monitor well there, and that's about the only one I have.
And then two other things. Basically, I'm going to guess that it was probably around 2005. My wife and I were up this way, and we were walking. And as you're going down towards Cactus Joe, where the bridge is, there was, I mean, water was flowing through there. I've never seen water through there. And all that would have probably have come from the mountains.
Charlie, if you look at 2005,
2005,
that was the highest on record. I mean, it was 300% of what normal was. So,
That was rainfall, so yeah, probably included the winter.
Yeah.
That was the only time because we had a Doberman, and he was basically almost swimming down there.
Yeah, it was definitely huge. I mean, that was definitely the... the highest
year. And the last thing is, and this doesn't deal with this, but it's just it was just something that came before us where they were talking about a power generation up on Blue Diamond Hill,
yes.
Where it's going to be like two ponds, okay, and basically what concerned me was the gentleman that was here said it would be basically be about 80 acre feet of evaporation per year. Now, I don't mean to put you on the spot, and if you can't answer this, fine. Does the water district ever look at a project and go, you know what, that doesn't really make sense?
There's like several of those.
There's yeah, a lot that of those.
Oh, really? Got shut down?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Just the water to initially, because I remember we took a review, we looked at that, and you know, just the water to prime that is a lot of water, and where that would come from. And then the evaporation that would occur over that was just tremendous. I mean, it just really, you know, I don't even know how it would be economically viable, but from a water standpoint, it was, you know, those are the type of projects that you just can't have in the desert where water is so precious, you know.
Yeah, good, so, good. I'm glad. Thank you, Jim. Thank you.
A general question. Why does Calico Basin have such a bad water problem? They have really, I mean, there are so many people's wells are going dry. And
oh, from quality or quantity?
No, just quantity in Calico Basin.
So I haven't studied that area specifically, but they also have a very limited aquifer, you know, because if you look at it, it's kind of in a basin, right? So all their recharges from the mountains that are around there. So when there's not a lot of recharge, or not a lot of snowmelt or anything like that, there's not much storage in the aquifer. So I would suspect that will also rebound back, that it also comes back quick. But the fact that there's no storage is that's where you see this, especially over multiple years of below normal precip. So that's what I wasn't sure about, if it was a water quality issue too, because sometimes when water is coming just through the bedrock more, after the water would drop, and the quality tends to drop.
I think there's quality problems too.
I've heard of a couple recently.
Yeah, like the horses can.
Because, you know, if you get new fresh water moving through the system, then that water is moving through quickly. But then as the more transmissive zones deplete, there's more water from the bedrock that tends to be, the water's in there longer, so it mineralizes more. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the issues with, or in here too, with trying to do something in bedrock, is the water quality is much poor because of some formations where there's more gypsum, but others. But I think that's just from what I know about it. Okay. So.
Jim, you answered one of my questions before about, I had written down septic tanks. And I was reading something in the newspaper the other day where in California, where they're taking some of the snowpack and they're putting it towards what was farmland, like 200 acres or something. Not 200, whatever it was. And they're basically going to make a reservoir type, so the water will seep in. But it did say in there that people were worried about the pesticides and stuff that were used on the farm. Since we are more pristine, BLM, where you know you're not using the chemicals, any worries on that? Not worries, but I mean concerns, like if there were a farm, horses, you know, 20 horses here, 20 horses there.
Yeah, it'd be site specific more, but you know, managed aquifer recharge is being looked at much more widely, especially across the West, especially in a place like California where that water may end up in the ocean and totally non-usable. So, but it's very much dependent on what was used there before. Like there's former orchards or areas, let's say in North part of Las Vegas where Gil Crease was, you know, in there. So there's residual there you want to be concerned about for nitrate and perchlorate, things like that.
Right.
But generally, you know, it's more site-specific.
Okay.
Specifically, natural, because it's not only just what's anthropogenic or man-made, but it's also other natural things in the soil that would leach out that you'd have to take a look at if you were doing a project like that.
Okay. When you say there's no insecticides, though, they were doing a program a few years ago in Calico Basin where they were going through all the wilderness stuff and spraying it down with some kind of herbicide that they were trying to knock back the cheatgrass. So I don't remember what the herbicide was. I stopped one of those guys and talked to him about it, but I don't remember what it was. But I don't know what the half-life of that stuff is or anything. So, But then it sounds like it's less about the open land where the perk is occurring in Calico Basin and more about coming through faults and stuff in the hills, I would guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and some of those herbicides and such, they tend to absorb onto the soil. They're not as soluble. Mm-hmm. You know, but it all depends on the material and everything too. So.
Okay. That was really amazing.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jim.
We have good news. You know, we always have good news together. So,
well, that was really a great presentation.
Thank you.
If you ever have any other questions or follow up, just let us know. And you know, we're always happy to work with everybody and always try to work to a good solution.
I do have one question. Now, what's the method you use for measuring static levels?
So, what we do is if you go out once a month with a water tape. Mm-hmm. You basically go and there's just a circuit that completes and hits.
That's just to
confirm the pressure transducer. So mm-hmm. there's a pressure transducer in the well. We know where it's set at, and it knows how much water is above it, and how much pressure.
So you get a constant reading off the pressure transducer, and then you confirm it with the electrical.
Yes, if there's stretch on the tape or anything like that, and that's all fed back through our SCADA system, so we can watch the wells.
Oh, cool.
Pretty much on real time.
Can I place a pressure transducer in my own well? Is that a meaningful thing that a private well could do?
You certainly could. Yeah. Yeah. If you wanted to. I mean, they're probably, depending on, they're, you know, $1,200 or more, depending on which one you use the cable. But certainly you could do that. You need a data logger to be able to.
Sure. Digital stuff's easier.
Yeah, in situ, if you look up in situ.
In situ?
I-N-S-S-I.
TU, yeah.
They're a manufacturer of that, and they are probably the leaders in pressure transducers and data loggers. Some people, they use a sonic, but those aren't that effective. I mean, it works if there's not a lot of interference.
I've been doing some reading on it. That's why I wanted to ask you what that was. Yeah.
It's not exactly. The other ones where you get to 1/100 of a foot.
It's 2017.
Well, thank you very much.
It sounds like you're really going to know your material. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Megan has asked for the presentation.
Wow, we're still rolling. That was an incredible presentation. Okay, I guess, well, can we have order, please? Because Megan has a presentation for us.
I do not have it ready for tonight. I'm still working on the project, so it's not done, so I'll have to do it upstairs.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. That was a lot of information to absorb in one night and a tough act to follow. Okay, so no Clark County 101 tonight. And now we're to general comments by the general public about matters relevant to the council's jurisdiction, not so much stuff that was on the agenda. Is there anything that people have for this? No? Okay. If we don't have any other questions then, our next meeting date is April 26th, and this meeting's hereby adjourned.
Thank you.
That was easy.
Sorry, I was going outside. I'm like dying of heat.
I do my best.